Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. People are still drifting in, so let's wait a little, 1 or 2 minutes. I don't want to waste the time of those who've been here on time. Maybe I think 1 more minute. I want to start. The second of 3 lectures on metaphysics, the first of which I delivered to you a few minutes ago or an hour ago. The second one will deal with why and how to study metaphysics. Why and how to study metaphysics. Although we start with why, in the title, I want to start with how. First, say a few words about it. This is a very difficult subject to try to pin down completely because human nature is diverse, but there are certain constants to which one can allude. First of all, as I said before, there are certain people who have gifts for metaphysics, for asking ultimate questions or concerned with ultimate questions. For some people, that's not so important in their life. And among those who do have this gift for asking about ultimate questions, that those who have the gift of being able to find an answer which satisfies their soul. So the question is, what is it in the human microcosm, in the human structure or constitution, that enables one to understand metaphysics? Where does that come from? Of course, it comes from God, but more than that. A lot of discussion has taken place in various traditions on the total structure of the human state. This traditional understanding of what it meant to be human, I will use the word man here in a generic sense as insan, not as a male, what it means to be a man or a human being, collapsed actually in the 16th, 17th century, in the West, and therefore in the whole worldview of modernism. When the French philosopher Descartes really reduced the intellect to reason and divided the human state, in fact the whole reality, into two departments or two dimensions called res cogitans in Latin and res extensa. That is the realm of knowledge, the realm of extension. He said everything in nature is extension, it's pure quantity. That's the foundation of a purely quantitative science, putting aside all the qualitative aspects. And but that's not the only substance in the world, the only reality. The other reality is the thinking mind, the mind. Now, the word mind itself is very problematic in non-Western languages. Of course, it comes from the Latin mens as a etymological, historical root. But anyway, I'm sorry if people walking around disturbing you, but I have no choice but to continue. I can't wait a minute. The word mind, of course, has a historical Latin root, mens, but it's not a traditional category of human faculties. If you study Arabic and say, well, what is mind? Among all of these books written on the faculties of the human being, why doesn't the word mind appear in it? The closest word to it is ذهن in Arabic, which is not one of the faculties at all. You have the word, for example, for خيال, imagination, for استدلال, ratiocination, for the حواس, the various senses, sensus communis, and so forth and so on. But you don't have any word for mind in the modern sense. What Descartes did was to collapse all the different faculties of the inner man into a single thing called the mind, in the beginning of rationalism. And the consequence of that was that one should be able to understand everything through the use of human reason. Human reason taken by itself, the famous idea of the hanging man of Descartes, he said we are to be hanged in the middle of space without touching anything, anybody, having any sensation, I would still have an experience of myself, and therefore reality begins with the certitude of my experience of myself. And this is the foundation of one of the greatest errors in human history from a metaphysical point of view, the saying of Descartes, which is the foundation to all of Western thought, that is cogito ergo sum in Latin, I think, therefore I am. And Islam would say, I think, therefore God is. I can think because there's God. He's giving the power of thinking. But I think, therefore I am, putting thinking before being, in a sense atrophied once and for all, the intellect as it was understood in Islamic metaphysics, in Hindu metaphysics, Buddhi, in Zen, in anything else. Zen, of course, is a somewhat different perspective. Tibetan Buddhism, anything of this kind, in the traditional schools of metaphysics. So we have to be able to navigate the field. There's so much mistake made by even modern Muslim thinkers because they have not really distinguished between the twin meanings of the word aql in Arabic as both intellect and reason. Depends how you use it. It depends how you use it. It doesn't only mean reason. And Islamic philosophers are not rationalists because they use the word aql. This is a total misunderstanding. In fact, Islam never tended to a rationalism, otherwise it would have ended up with the West, where the West ended up. In fact, it always rejected that possibility because what never took place was the divorce between reason and the intellect. That never took place in Islam. And one or two very peripheral figures who tried to do this, they had no influence. Or if not Rawandi, those that are the scholars of Islamic thought, you know, that one or two thinkers, even Abu al-Ala al-Ma'arri, the famous Syrian poet, beautiful poetry wrote, who was blind, but he said he was a rationalist. That is somewhat far-fetched. But they were not significant figures. Ibn Sina was not a rationalist. Even Averroes was not a rationalist in the modern sense of Descartes. So the reduction of this faculty that is in us, that is the light that is within us, that is so clear in the Quran and Hadith, Al-Aqlunurun, it's a hadith of the Prophet. It's itself a light that God has placed within us with which we gain real knowledge. This was completely forgotten. And so in order to understand how we can study metaphysics, we must realize that there's a faculty in us that is appropriate to study a metaphysics. And that faculty is aql. In the original sense, for those of you who do not know, many of you are young students, the word aql, which it has entered all Islamic languages, we use for even being wise in everyday life, being practical. We use it in many, many different ways in Arabic, but mostly the Quran identifies it with the confirmation of Tawheed. وَهُمْ لِيَعْقَلُونَ That means those who cannot intellect. I never translate those who cannot reason. Those who cannot intellect, that is, who cannot understand divine unity. To use aql is to understand that God is one. Islam, the Quran always relates the teaching of God as the one with aql as a way of being able to discern and understand it. There's no such thing as Quranic rationalism so many modernized Muslims write about. It's total nonsense. And there's no such thing. This aql is not simply modern reason. It's very interesting. The word aql comes from the Arabic root aqal, which means, like every Arabic root has to do with the camel. It means to tether the camel, tie the camel to something. It means so it doesn't run away. It means to bind our aql to God, to bind that noetic faculty that we have to God. The wonderful word comes from Greek. We always use in its adjectival form, not in its noun form, the word noesis, which is a Greek word. We use the word noetic, which has now made a big comeback in America, especially in California, where they're trying to revive some traditional sciences instead of noetic sciences in San Francisco, some city near there, somewhere near San Francisco, I think somewhere around there. Noetic sciences. But noesis itself has not come to English. It was used occasionally in the Renaissance, in English Renaissance period, but not now. But noetic, we all know. It has to do with Greek word noesis, which is the same as the Latin word intellectus, which means a kind of light that is able to understand the subject of its own knowledge and become identified with it. In a sense, a knowledge that unifies. To become unified, what's called an ittihad al-aql wal-ma'qul in Islamic metaphysics, the unity of the knower and the known, to unify us with the subject that knows, the object that is known. That is us, the subject that knows, to become unified with the object that is known. Now, in practical purposes, although it's possible for some people to have metaphysical intuition, unless they belong to a tradition, unless the rest of the nafs is trained, that intuition usually wears away. So for all practical purposes, there is no metaphysics outside of religion. And by religion, I do not mean simply the law. I mean the total tradition. There is no metaphysics in the Islamic world, from Malaysia to Morocco, without Islam. There is no metaphysics in India without Hinduism. There is no metaphysics in China without either Neo-Confucianism or Taoism. There's no metaphysics in the Buddhist world without Buddhism, and etc. There's no exception to the rule. If you say, but what about the Greeks? What about Aristotle himself and Plato? They were the remnants of the Greek religion. Greek philosophy was born on the cadaver of the death of the Greek religion. The Orphic aspect of the Greek religion, which is the metaphysical aspect, was gradually dying out, and out of it was born Platonism, and from then Aristotelianism and then Neoplatonism. So that's an exception to the rule, in a sense. And it ended up in the death of that civilization anyway. The people who really benefited from Plotinus were Muslims and Christians. The Greeks were not around any longer. They were not really around any longer because the religion had died. But this is not even that, it's not an exception. The Westerners have tended to think of Greek philosophy as divorced from practice. That's not true in the deeper sense. Parmenides says so. I mean, especially the pre-Socratics. I don't want to get into a discussion of philosophy here. Many of you may not be prepared for it, but unfortunately I'm a philosopher, so I have to say a couple of words about it. But remember that when they asked Plato, what is philosophy? He said, philosophy is the practice of death. Nothing could be farther away from coarse analytical philosophy at the University of Toronto. Nothing in the world. So it's that philosophy which is not, even that is not an exception. When Socrates was drinking the hemlock, the poison that killed him, look at what he spoke. You couldn't have got a single professor of philosophy in a Western university to take hemlock and say the same thing. So even that is not an exception. Metaphysics is always found in the bosom of religion. Its language is always drawn from religious symbolism. Or the abstract language, which providentially, certain forms of Greek thought, which goes back to great knowledge to Egypt, developed for the Mediterranean world, which allowed the three monotheistic religions, that is, Abrahamic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, to have recourse to a philosophical language which is shared in common, that is, came from Greek, but originally from religious elements in both Greek and Egyptian traditions, and to make use of it. But for us as Muslims, because almost everybody here in this audience is of an Islamic background, so I give myself the right to speak mostly about that, intellect is a faculty mentioned in the Quran by which God has given us the possibility of knowing. And also knowing the One, knowing the truth in the ultimate sense. And the Quran distinguishes very clearly the significance of using your intellect and not using your intellect. Do those who know and those who do not know the same? The Quran asks. So it's a very fundamental, very, very fundamental concept in the Quran, the aql. And then the Prophet has all these hadiths about aql. Sayyidina Ali had a famous say, he said the most precious thing that God created in the world was aql. all of the great figures of early Islam, Sunni and Shiite alike, to emphasize this, but especially the inner dimension of Islam, emphasize the importance of Aql. That is the way to know the One, to know the Absolute, and therefore that is the way to metaphysics. Now, to open a parenthesis here, for those of you who come and say, ah, what are you saying? Didn't Jalaluddin Rumi, the greatest of all mystics, attack Aql and say, Pai istadalyan chubim babad, Pai chubim sahbi tankim babad, famous. That is the leg of rationalism, is a wooden leg, and a wooden leg is always wobbly, doesn't stand. Didn't he say that? Yeah, I have said that so many times. Yes, what he was criticizing was rationalism precisely, was the Cartesian Aql, not the Islamic Aql. And that's why he said, Aql juz'i, Aql ra badam kar, the partial intellect, which means reason, ruined the name of the real intellect. Which is exactly what happened in Western civilization. And once that happened, metaphysics came to an end. Now, there's one more point to add. This emphasis I've placed upon the practice of Aql, this inner faculty within us, this inner eye, Ayn al-Qalb, as the Sufis say, which is within us, allows us to open. That's the difficult part. The eye is there. We just have to help it to open through virtue, through love, through practice. But I won't get into that. There's another element that's related to it. And this is, might seem paradoxical, but it's always been so in the Abrahamic world. The Hindu world is somewhat different. I don't want to enter into it now. And that is the element of faith. Somehow, all the metaphysics seems to have nothing to do with faith. Its realization has everything to do with faith. Faith, in a sense, is the participation in something I do not know. You cannot say, our faith is now 6:30 and Sir Rosenas is lecturing in front of me. That's not faith. But you might say that you have faith that he will stop talking too much in the next hour. I'm getting tired. Because I heard him before. So you're anticipating. You're anticipating something that's not there yet. This anticipation is not in the theoretical aspect of metaphysics. Because it's possible to understand metaphysics theoretically without having faith. But it's impossible to realize metaphysics without having faith. To realize the truth of metaphysics always implies iman. And in Islam, you have this wonderful play of words for which Arabic is so rich. Many people contrasted pure metaphysics of Islam with Greek philosophy by referring to al-hikmatul imaniyah wa al-hikmatul yunaniyah. That is, the word Yunan and Iman are similar. Yunan means Greek, Greece. Iman means faith in Arabic. But distinguish between al-hikmatul imaniyah, that is a metaphysics based related to faith, and or Yamaniyah even sometimes, which means both Yaman and the East and the right hand and faith. All of these are roots are connected together in Arabic. And al-hikmatul yunaniyah, which they contrasted with it. So you run across this expression, it shows you what I'm trying to say, that when it comes to realization of the truth, it's impossible to realize it without faith. But theoretical understanding of it is possible. On a certain level, metaphysics is the highest science, and like you can be a mathematician and be a good person or bad person with a good mathematician. You can be a good person or bad person and be a metaphysician for a while. If you continue to be a bad person, the intuition usually disappears. And soon you have a fall. How many people have you seen in the 20th century who wrote brilliant books when they were 25 years old and wrote trivialities when they were 50 years old because they didn't do anything with that intuition which God has given them? Now, having said how to study metaphysics a little bit, I want to answer the other question, why should you study metaphysics? Why? Of course, for those who, for whom it's an existential need, the question doesn't arise. Well, why am I scratching my head? Because it's itching. I don't even ask myself this question because it's immediate. As soon as my head itches, I scratch. So that, besides the point. But one can ask philosophically, logically, why spend time studying metaphysics? Does it make us be better people? Does it make us go to heaven? Does it make us earn more money? Does it make us love our children more? Why are we doing this? It's important to answer this question. It's a very, very important question. The answers are extremely important for humanity, I believe. First of all, let me go back to what I said the last lecture. No religion can survive without a living metaphysical tradition within it. This is my view. And that of many others. My view is trivial. Who am I to have my view? But I mean, since we're used to saying this, I'm a person who studied religion for over half a century. I can attest to historical sources of this. As I said, the reason is very, very simple. Different human beings have different needs for causality. Usually between the age of 15 and 17, there occurs in the human being what Islamic sources, traditional Islamic sources, call a kind of divine attack, hamla ilahiya. Divine ilahiya in the sense that everybody begins to think about God for a while. We all teenagers for a short moment of time. Most put it aside and pay attention to other things, not to iPads and before and all the playing football in the street. But a few cannot let it go. And these questions become existential for them. I don't like to talk about myself, but there were days when I was 16 years old when I would keep away all night long thinking only about purely metaphysical questions. Where would I be if there would be no heaven and earth? And questions like this: where is the origin of my being? Why can't I go back in my memory to the origin of my own existence? Where is it originated from? Most people don't bother asking this question. They don't keep awake 2 o'clock in the morning asking this question. But I make this autobiographical because it's important for you to realize, for a person for whom these questions arise, there's no way but to try to find an answer. In the same way, if you have pain in your muscle and you want to drive your bicycle, you have to find a doctor to cure the pain in your muscle. That's it. And so, there's an urge that exists in all religions. It's not unique to Arabs or Persians or Hindus or Chinese or Japanese or anybody else, Italians, Germans, anybody else. God has created us in such a way, in the same way that every city of 1 million people, you have a few very fine painters, a few very fine musicians. You also have a few people who have this kind of philosophical inner constitution. And if the religion is going to keep them within its fold, it has to be able to provide an answer for them. And that answer can never come from just obey your parents, be good, follow the law. So what? Yes, of course. But that doesn't answer why 2 and 2 is 4. A logical question needs a logical answer. An ethical question is an ethical answer. Obviously. A question about love needs a response that has to do with love. Everything in life is like this. Only the like can respond to the like. So when a metaphysical question comes up like that, in most families, the parents have they don't have the power to do anything about it. How happy is a child whose father can answer it like that? I was one of those children. My father was one of the greatest philosophers of Iran. Every question I had, he could answer. Unfortunately, I was 12 years old when he died. But many families do not have that. So where do they go? Traditional religions always found the channels, remarkably well successful, to answer some of these questions, starting simple stories for children, musical tales, poems that people memorized. I just recited 1 or 2 poems for you in Persian. I know all these poems when I'm 10 years old. And they contain the deepest responses to some of these questions. And then the child grew up a bit more, 16, 17, 18, gradually more intellectual explanations were given to those children. And so the religion was able to keep within its fold its most intelligent members. I repeated that, I hate to say this, but between the 17th and the 19th century, not all, but most of the most intelligent people in Christianity left Christianity. Not the people of simple intelligence. People of very high intelligence. You want proof of it? Sir Isaac Newton was a very devout man, the father of classical physics. Today, 70% of all scientists are atheists. That's it. Not only Newton, but almost all of the famous physicists of the 17th century, except for Galileo, was a maverick. Even he was not an atheist, but was a maverick against the church. He said he believed in God. But Kepler was a very devout, pious person. And Newton was one of the most pious people. And what happened? What happened? Exactly what I said. So the first role of metaphysics is the preservation of religion. Whenever metaphysics is lost, a religion gradually either exteriorizes itself, like it's happening today, in both Christianity and now to a certain extent Islam, with the rise of fundamentalism. And secondly, oftentimes, as it happened in the old days, it turns into a dissolution into magic. What happened actually with the Greek religion, the Roman religion, the Babylonian religion, with Chaldean religion, with the Egyptian religion, the great Egyptian religion after 4,000 years. What did it die from? It died from magic. You go to the tomb of Ramses VI in Egypt, which I discovered a few years ago, you go a whole kilometer inside, unbelievable, unbelievable tomb. You feel it. You feel as if the power of magic, that's why so many women vomit, men less so. Because the snake has always more effect upon the women than on men. The snake symbolizes the psychic forces, of course, in religious mythology. So that's what happens to the religion. You must understand that. Why am I speaking to you people here? Not to teach you a little bit of metaphysics, but also to Islam and religion. Islam cannot do without its knowledge. It's not enough to shoot blindfolded some woman in the back in Syria and call it la ilaha illallah. That's not enough. It's not for enough. That's heresy of the worst kind. But to call it Islam, that's not it. Islam needs knowledge more than ever before. And because what is happening in the Islamic world today is not 100%, but to a large extent what happened to the Christian world in the Renaissance and 17th century. That is, our most brilliant children are forced by their parents to study the modern medicine and modern engineering. Most of whom hate the subject. I have 15 friends in Washington, I live in Washington, who are major Iranian musicians. I mean, really top-rated Iranian musicians, all of whom wanted to study music, but they're all doctors in hospitals. Because their father, with the force of a gun, forced them to become doctors. You all know these stories very well. And it's become the ideal. I was once the president of the most important university in the Islamic world, the Sharif University, which you turn up today, which students can get into Stanford without even examination. It was called Ari Mir University. Then. Unbelievably brilliant students. The first thing I did was to create the Department of Humanities. This is a waste of the best energy of our people to all study physics and engineering and so forth. What about the humanities? What about religion? And look what happened. Many of them became fundamentalists, many of them communists. They split in half. Both threw bombs. They almost killed me. One of them almost killed me, one of the president of the university. I've seen this from nearby. That is, our most intelligent people are no longer studying Islam. I'm not saying none does. I didn't say it. There are exceptions. Especially in Iran, the last few years, there have been some very, very brilliant young men. Because I began as a physicist, ended up as an Islamic scholar. Many have tried to follow this. I don't know, about 20 of them. I've been studying physics and mathematics myself, except they didn't come to MIT. They studied in some other place. They're now studying in Burma, with a turban around their head, and studying Islamic thought. And in Pakistan, we have a few. In Egypt, practically none. Maybe one or two. Some in North Africa. I'm not saying there's none. But by and large, it's not like the old days, where in every family in the Islamic world, the most intelligent person would be led by his parents to study religion, obviously. Where is this wonderful song coming from? I wish it were a wonderful song. In the Islamic world, we have this crisis that has come up. And in the crisis that pretty soon, you're going to have mediocrity ruling over our ulama. As long as 50 years ago, even in some faraway places, even today. Even today in some places in West Africa, some places in Asia, faraway places, not the major Islamic countries. The ulama were the most intelligent people in society. Not only pious guardians of the religion, but also intellectually. Intellectually. This is no longer the case. And so we have, first of all, a whole army of amateur Muslim doctors writing on the Quran. They keep commenting on the Quran as if it's child's play, without the real knowledge, but very good doctors. Most things being written on Islam today are written by people who don't have the technical training. They're very nice people, many of them are my good friends, but they don't have the knowledge in depth. And so the whole level of our scholarship is coming down, and it's a major, major, of course, challenge to the Islamic world. To be frank with you, I should have said in prayer for him, but I'm having a lot of hopes in this small Zaytuna College that Abdul Yusuf created in California. We serve as a model in this country to send some of our most bright, best children to do Islamic studies. We owe that to God. That's what our ancestors did. That's why we still have faith. If your great-grandfather had sent every one of his most intelligent children to a bazaar to become rag merchants, and the one had the lowest IQ to become the ulama, there was no Islam left in the world. So this is a major, major crisis, of course, that faces the whole Islamic world, each place in a different way. But the important thing that we can learn from, I hope, from today's lesson, is that without metaphysical thinking, religion becomes lame. Opens the door to all forms of secularism. Most religious ulama today have no answer to the challenge of secularism. It's not that I've said takfir, Allah, Akbar, that's not going to solve anything. You have to answer thought with thought. You cannot answer thoughtful challenges with emotions or shouting. That's not going to do it. That's not going to do it. That's one of the greatest challenges of the Islamic world today, is to provide an Islamic answer for modern secularism. Even in the Islamic Republic of Iran, which was founded for the sake of Islam, there are a lot of young kids who are secularists. They write to me all the time at the university. They don't understand the Islamic point of view, and the point of view has been presented to them in public. It's hard for them to answer certain questions they have in their heart. And the government knows it's a crisis. In a country like Egypt, which has now become a military dictatorship, it's bad in another way. Each country, Islamic country, is suffering, and then the whole rise of the Salafi Wahhabi strain of Islam, which refuses to ask profound questions. You're not supposed to ask profound questions. It's not helping the situation either. So we are living in a very, very difficult situation, and we have to learn from the West. I don't understand why we Muslims are so good in learning from the West how to cut the size of our skirt of our women, but not from the bad experiences of the West, not to do it. I mean, why is it we cannot learn? I mean, human beings, if you learn that your aunt ate cabbages and was very good for her stomach, but she ate a lot of red meat and caused bleeding, you won't do it. Why is it we never learn from the mistakes of the West? What is wrong with us? I mean, I speak as a Muslim who's been devoted his whole life to Islamic causes. What are we doing? I mean, it's so evident what has happened in the West. But we are insistent on making the same mistakes. Our leaders, unfortunately, insist in making the same mistakes. Almost. Little things, yes, may be different. Little things. But the major things, unfortunately, we're doing the same thing. And I think the history of the West, how secularism rose, how the eclipse of metaphysics brought about the weakening of religion, how from the Galileo trial to right now when Pope Francis is the Pope, Catholicism has been going backwards step by step vis-a-vis all the challenges that come to it. Not one step forward, always giving up ground, always on the defensive. Religion is reduced to loving your neighbor, but has nothing to say about the structure of the world, by the nature of reality. It's immediately laughed off by modern science. And this is going to happen to us, obviously, if you don't watch out. Now, having said this in general, let me turn more particularly to a few specific subjects. First of all, knowledge itself. Without metaphysics, that is knowledge of principles, knowledge has no choice but to become secularized. And a nation, a civilization, which has no word for secular, there's no word for secular in Arabic, which everything is immersed in the sacred, and everything is becoming secularized, starting with knowledge first. That is, I know that people, a lot of Muslim doctors pray every day, they're very pious, but the medicine has nothing to do with their praying, except on the ethical level, that has nothing to do with knowledge. Just a very nice man, they treat poor people well without asking exorbitant prices. Alhamdulillah, that's wonderful. That has nothing to do with the injection they give. That has nothing to do with Islam or not, no. And nobody even wants to realize this. I have a lot to say about this. I've been president of the most important scientific technical university in the Islamic world for many years. And I've had a lot of background in both science and philosophy and theology and everything. And there's a lot in my heart that I would like to say that I cannot say in public even. Because every government is offended. If you say something, they take it personally. But the truth of the matter is that, unfortunately, governments even throughout the world that claim to be very religious have no understanding about secularized knowledge. One place I can talk about very clearly is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a very wealthy country, one of the wealthiest, perhaps the wealthiest country in the world. They have all the money to waste for anything you can imagine. And they spend a lot of money not wastefully building very good universities. I helped a lot. I helped sort of the medical school for Riyadh when I was in Iran. I used to go to Saudi Arabia all the time in those days. I don't go anymore. And what happened when they established this university? This very, very pious university. The first thing they did was to exclude all the humanities. Only Sharia and Western science and technology. Only now, gradually, they even begin to study to teach Arabic. Philosophy is banned from outside the universities. I was once giving advice to the highest authorities of Saudi Arabia, as Minister of Awqaf and Minister of Science of Saudi Arabia, on the building of the Science Museum in Riyadh. And while I was doing that, 6-7 ministers sitting here in front of me, one of my students was arrested at the airport. They called me up because he was having my book, Islamic Science, in his bag. Islamic Science and Research Study, the famous book that I brought out 34 years ago. I've seen the Arabic version of it. Al-Ulum fil Islam. And he was arrested because of one picture of the Mi'raj of the Prophet, a Turkish miniature with the face of the Prophet covered. That was against Islam. But building a 100-floor monstrosity next to the Kaaba, which has reduced the Kaaba to this big, that's not against Islam, as long as you charge $1,500 for a room a night. This is the fruit of the loss of a total vision. I'm giving Saudi Arabia on purpose, because that's the extreme form of it. And although I was invited by King Abdullah to go to Al-Hajj, maybe he doesn't listen to what I'm saying, alhamdulillah. I didn't accept that I'm not going to the Hajj. I've done enough. Let's leave Mecca for others. I don't want to be a glutton in making the Hajj. But that's what happens when the humanities, metaphysics, thinking is taken out of the equation. And you say your prayers automatically, and then you do engineering. Without thinking, what is engineering based on? Or what is modern physics based on? It's based on a world cut off from the hands of God, in which the nature of God is irrelevant. You can be a devout Muslim and be a good physicist, like Abdus Salam, and of course it was Qadiani, but was a good Muslim, prayed all the time, and win the Nobel Prize, at least from that point of view. Nobel Prize in physics. You can be an atheist and win the Nobel Prize in physics, which means God is irrelevant to the whole enterprise. Why do we admit it? Where are our Muslim thinkers? Why is it that I have to shout all the time? I mean, this is obvious. It's obvious, taking great pride that we have now these remarkable physicists and so forth, like they do in my own country. All right, fine, but that's what does that do with Islam? What does that have to do with Islam? The Japanese are not Muslims, and look what they've done in physics. Look at what the Chinese are doing. Put aside the West. India, Hindu India has more fine mathematicians than all the Islamic world put together. Nothing to do with the price of eggs in China, as they say. We are stuck. We're stuck because we are trying to take out of the equation of our education, of our worldview, that supreme science of the real. Make it irrelevant. And then it has this percolating effect upon everything. And the first thing that it affects is knowledge itself, which becomes secularized. So we're now facing the Islamic world, which is supposed to be based on Tawheed. Universities, all of which are compartmentalized. They cut in half. Half are secular subjects, which are just like any Western university. And then you have Kuliyat al-Sharia, not to be left behind. Even the Islamic universities, they worked so hard in the 60s and 70s, the world, First World Congress on Education, which I organized with Dr. Zubair and others in Mecca. And I spoke there before everybody, 600 presidents of universities all the Islamic world. I had the main talk. What has happened 40 years later? Even the Islamic University upon the Kuala Lumpur in Nigeria and here, there, they all are just Western universities with the Department of Sharia. That's all we've been able to do. We've lost the unity of knowledge, which was fundamental to Islamic civilization. There's nothing more fundamental. Even the word ulama showed this universality and unity. Today in Arabic, on the one hand, ulama means those with turban who know Islamic law. On the other hand, those who teach physics at Ain Shams University, they're also called ulama. But they have nothing to do with each other. They're living in two different universes. Whereas when Ibn Sina had a big turban on his head, and he was one of the ulama, he was part of a class of people who had different sciences, all of which were related. All of which were related. Some were more specialists in Islamic law, some in grammar, some in history, some in medicine, some in mathematics. Well, take it whatever you like. But they were all interrelated. That we have lost. Concomitant to that, something about which I want to speak very severely is the question of the destruction of Islamic art. Now, many people think that art is a luxury. It's sort of for rich people who, after having achieved everything, then buy a piece of calligraphy which is backwards and put it on the wall because the Muslims love backwards calligraphy. You know what I mean? A mirrored calligraphy that is the other way around. Or some nice Arab or Persian woman who takes a pen and goes like this and creates some abstract art that you could detect the noon or ayn somewhere in between. This is what we call Islamic. Of course, that's not Islamic art. That's something else. But I want to come back to that. This is not a question of luxury. It's a matter of life and death. Why? Because of the hadith. God loves, is beautiful and loves beauty. Allahu jamilun yuhibbu jamal. Now if God is beautiful and loves beauty, to do things ugly is to do things that God does not love. And therefore removes us from God. It's as simple as that. Have you ever thought that even now, if you go among the Bedouins of southern Algeria, in the desert, living very, very simply, the Tuareg or someone like that, how beautiful everything is? Have you ever thought of that? Even the tents are so beautifully made. The carpets, you couldn't find one in Toronto. If you found it, you bought immediately. Go all the way from there to the Shalimar Garden or the Jami Mosque of Isfahan or the Great Mosque of India or Sultan Hassan in Cairo. Thousands of remarkable buildings and bazaars and palaces and everything. In Islamic civilization, I'm not saying Islamic civilization is the only one. Islamic civilization, because of the theological structure, because God manifests himself in Islam primarily as beauty, even over goodness in many ways. And of course, the two are united by the fact that in Arabic, the word husn means both goodness and beauty. And so Islam refuses to even separate the two. It's remarkable. This one word is enough to reveal the whole philosophy of Islam concerning art and beauty. Art pervaded and was pervasive. It was everywhere. And it was not even called art in this sense, because sana'a, making, had to do with sona, God is, one of his names is Sania. And son is a divine quality to make. And he has given us the power to make. And this went through all the arts. All the arts, both plastic and sonoral. Oral arts, like poetry and music. I mean, you cannot imagine. You can, of course, you stretch yourself, but it's hard. That if a few hundred years ago, even 100 years ago, you walk through an Islamic city, you would only hear beautiful sounds, either the sound of the adhan, or some song being sung by someone in the shop, or someone playing some instrument. Beautiful sound was everywhere. I mean, can you imagine what they've done in 100 years? The noise of Tehran or Cairo, what they've done to ourselves. But you must remember, why was this done? Because Islamic art is a way to make manifest the deepest aspect of the religion, deeper than the legal aspects of the religion, through forms which save the soul without fully understanding its metaphysics, but it's based on metaphysics. How was Islamic art created? Why is Ali called the founder of calligraphy in Islam by both Sunnis and Shiites? Well, he was also the first Muslim metaphysician. For natural balagha is the first work of metaphysics in Islam, after the Quran. The Quran is not a book of metaphysics, it's a sacred scripture. But this is the natural balagha of Ali. And oftentimes he's been called the first Muslim metaphysician. My own teacher, Allama Tabatabai, Rahmatullah Alayhi, once wrote a book called Allah, Ali and Metaphysics, which is now out in English. You should read it. I don't do it with Greek or anything else. It shows this centrality of this form of knowledge from the very, very beginning. And it's not accidental, it was also called the founder of Islamic calligraphy, the most important form of Islamic art. And throughout the centuries, we had this nexus like this between metaphysical knowledge, the cosmological knowledge and geometry that derived from it, and the plastic arts, and on the other side, the sonoral arts. 90% of all great metaphysicians were poets. Poets all the way from the rank of Rumi and Ibn Arabi to a little bit lower. And before the 20th century, most of the classical music in the Islamic world was cultivated by Sufis, and there was behind it a complete metaphysics. And the music led you to God. The role of music, classical music in the Islamic world, is to lead us to God. Again, the remarkable Jalaluddin Rumi, this I promise you my last poem for tonight, says, Motriba ghazid nazd turk mast dar hijab naghme asrar alast. That is, the musician began to play before the drunken Turk. Here, the drunken Turk symbolizes a person in search of knowledge. Behind the veil of songs, the mystery of Alas, the divine covenant that we made with God before the creation of the world. But the Quran says, Alas tu bi rabbikum. And kum, addressing all of us, am I not your Lord, not thy Lord? Alas tu bi rabbika, now Alas tu bi rabbikum. And we all said bala. We all participated in that yet. Qalu bala, not qala bala, qalu. They said, we all said yes. And that yes is that eternal covenant with God, which we have made. Happy are those who keep that covenant. And can you imagine, Rumi says, that music unveils the mysteries of this covenant with God. I mean, nothing can be said about an art higher than that. This is civilization which we had, whether we are Persian, Arabic, Turkish, Northern Indian, Muslim, Malay. I once, a concert was given my honor in Jakarta. Not Jakarta, Java, near another city, Bandung, called Sundanism. I never heard of it. Unbelievably beautiful. Music, religious music that was sung, local traditions, unbelievable traditional music, which we had preserved for centuries. And now we're ruining it. We're ruining it right before our eyes, even those who talk about traditional music. It's a sad story for another day. But these are all examples of what happens when the metaphysical center is lost. In those days, you always had a great master, whether it was a miniature or music, who had his heart in the metaphysical truth, was usually himself a sheikh or very learned person in metaphysics. And he would apply that in his art, and other people would learn. It is that which is disappearing very fast amidst us. Then besides knowledge and art, you have ethics. No society can survive without ethics. Many Western philosophers claim that you can have non-religious ethics. You know, the books come out right in the city. Some very important books have come out, philosophical books about philosophical ethics. This is Thomas Hobbes in the 17th century. Europeans have been writing about ethics divorced from religion. But I don't want to discuss now the Western case. That's what I really like. But can you imagine in any Islamic city, even big ones where there are a lot of modern educated and westernized people, let's say my own city, Tehran. If some professor at philosophy at Tehran University, where I was a professor once and taught for 20 years, my own faculty, would come to the street in front of Tehran University, so I've shown philosophically that ethically it's not correct to, let's say, put your foot on an ant that's crawling on the sidewalk. Nobody would listen to him, not even two people. But if a religious alim would come and say this is against Islamic law, it would have an effect. In the sense that instigation of so much evil that's going on in Pakistan and Afghanistan the other way is taking place in this way. Why is it that the secular government of Pakistan could not do it all those years? Why is it that Yaqub Khan, who was such a powerful person, could not do it? Nobody would listen. They listened to the ulama. Our people still listen to the religious scholars. And therefore, if this aspect of knowledge, sapiential knowledge, the metaphysics of which I'm speaking, disappears, it's very hard to make ethical arguments stick, you might say, and certainly absolute, to lose the philosophical background. And with it comes either what we call a ta'ammudi, that is simply a willful acceptance because my father said so, or one that throws them away. Hypocrisy, that we see so much down the stone before. Outwardly, you keep some ethical norm, but you really don't believe in it. You go and do something else when you're alone. And that has done a lot of harm to the Islamic world. The direct link between ethics and metaphysics. And nowhere has been brought out more than in Sufi texts. You read the Risalat al-Qushayri, Imam Qushayri, written in the 11th, 12th century, one of the greatest treatises of Islamic ethics and Sufi ethics. You will see it, and Ghazali and all of those people. And what happened in Islamic civilization is that after Mongol invasion, Sufi ethics really breathed into Islamic ethics in general. And it became the norm for Islamic ethics. That's why if you come out of Azhar Mosque at the Friday prayers today, and next week in Cairo, the books on the ground on ethics are almost all by Ghazali, or Zarruq, or someone like that. They're almost all of them. Ethics written by Fuqaha, nobody reads. Or very few people read, except these modern Salafis and so on. The tradition of Islam, breath of spirituality, in a sense, was inbreathed into ethics and kept ethics alive, and of course, example of people. Nothing is better for ethics than the example of a human person who's ethical. So to talk about ethics is not enough. And that also came to people who were trained in metaphysics, in Sufi orders, and who accomplished things remarkably. One of the most important debates that is going on in the Western world today and now has permeated the Islamic world, the debate between religion and science. From the time that Jamaluddin Afghani or Asadabadi in the 19th century began to write on this matter, and Al-Iskandarani in Egypt and others until now, it's also become a major debate among Muslims about religion and science. Most Muslims say the following. Science is ilm. God said seek knowledge even if it's in China or from cradle to the grave. So to seek science from cradle to the grave is a religious act. So there's no problem between religion and science in Islam. That's the usual discussion that goes on and on and on and on. I don't want you to tell the story about when I spoke before Lagari, the president of Pakistan, against this view, and he tore up his paper and threw everybody in order to negate what I was saying and said something else. I won't go into that story, but I've had a lot of experience with that. I don't do go there anymore, go to the Islamic world anymore for these things. I've done enough. Many few people do it now. But many Muslims don't even understand what the problem is. It's unbelievable. Why is it that over 50% of Japanese have become atheists since the Second World War? Where Buddhism and Shintoism were so strong. But in the military of Japan, we're all Shintoists. What happened? The secularism came through Western science and technology. How are we going to avoid that? Nobody wants to talk about it. But it's a very, very important subject. It's like the subject of religion and science, how they're related together, stopping to think of facile weddings, which in fact cannot take place, but think of where there are points of contention, where it is that modern science has to understand its own limitations. I cannot simply overrun the territory of religion one after another. We start inside the human mind, trying to reduce the human person to an automaton, and after that there's nothing left, and trying to create life in test tube. And this is not going to happen. But the way they talk about it, it's as if, you know, it's just around the corner for science to explain everything and makes religion redundant, which is totally absurd. I'm going to talk about this issue in a major lecture I'm giving to the big audience tomorrow, so I will not trouble you with this now. But it's very important to understand that what is missing in this whole discussion is metaphysics. Only metaphysics can show the principles of all sciences, including modern science. What are the limitations of modern science? What it means when you reduce a falling apple from a tree on Newton's head to mass and motion and gravitational field of the Earth? What have you done? These are important issues, extremely important issues, which only the metaphysical background can answer. Finally, to come back to art, before I end this section of my talk, what happened in the West was gradually a humanization of sacred art. That is, Christ began to be painted as just a nice-looking human being with a long beard. Of course, he was always blonde, but that's besides the point. And the Virgin Mary as a nice-looking, very nice woman. And Ivan Raphael, famous the Virgin, which is one of the most famous paintings of the Virgin, the famous Raphael, the Italian painter, was a 16-year-old girl from Florence whom brought into his studio and he painted. Whereas the medieval paintings of the Virgin all have these black faces, they're elongated, they don't look naturalistic at all. But it's those that do miracles for Christians, not this nice-looking Italian girl. It's very interesting. They don't do any miracles. They look nice to our untrained eyes. But what happened in Christianity was that it took place a humanization of sacred art. That the images of God were humanized. And once that happened, it took only a short time before it became dehumanized. With the 20th century art, which breaks the image. And even as a pious French painter as Rouault, paints the Christ in a kind of cubistic form, and it really falls below the human, below the natural. They call it surnaturel, surrealism. It's not really surrealism, it's subrealism. It falls below the ordinary realism of naturalism, of humanization of Christian art. Now, fortunately in Islam, we do not have images of God, so we're safe from that. But we have the naturalization of a traditional art going on all the time. And this is, you might say, how does that have to do with metaphysics? It has to do with the loss of a vision of art that ends up in this. Why is it that all of our wealthy people, kind of Saudi Arabia, have the most decadent form of furniture, Louis XIV furniture, gilded furniture that on Edgware Road in London, they make only for rich Muslims. No Englishman would ever buy it. Would be caught dead buying something like that. Why are we doing this? Am I wrong? Or I'm not wrong. Unfortunately, I'm right. Even simple Swedish furniture, which happens to be more like Islamic furniture, but there's simplicity, I see very few Muslims ever wanting to buy it. What is happening? What's happening, it's true, we don't have the humanization of the sacred form of God, because we don't have that under the law. But we have a kind of naturalization of our traditional art. Even Persian carpets, one of the greatest masterpieces of Islamic art, are now beginning to look more and more naturalistic and floral. What happened to all of our geometric designs, like those incredible patterns of Islamic art? I'm not saying they're totally absent, but besides the colors becoming more and more gaudy, the forms are becoming less and less traditional. So you begin to see the immediate impact of it, all the way from ugly buildings that are cropping up in the Islamic world, to the furniture in houses which are no longer Islamic, to the one thing that remained, the carpet, which is still Islamic, now is becoming more naturalistic and less symbolic in its forms, and although there's still good carpets that are produced, I'm not saying they're not, but it's getting worse and worse. And all of this has to do with the loss of a worldview. Loss of something that's based on a knowledge of reality. And people go to the West, they copy, and they come back, and those who are rich just blindfoldly support decadent things. I don't want to get in the field of art, but one of the great tragedies that occurred in the Islamic world, every art needs a patron. In the old days, the great patrons of all Islamic art were either the rich merchants, the ulama through their madrasas, Sufi orders. Put the court aside, that was just in one city, let's say Istanbul. Yes, of course, the courts played a role, but locally. But these three were all over the Islamic world. What happened in the 19th century onward is that the class of ulama and Sufis became less wealthy, could not support very big projects so easily. The merchant class became still richer, but it became more and more westernized, and the aristocracy, which has supported high art, was the first to become westernized. And so you lost the patronage for traditional art. And gradually you lost the traditional art in these upper classes. It began in Egypt, then it began in Iran and among the Muslims of India, and then it went to other countries, and Turkey, these four places, then it went elsewhere. Yemen, let's say, came much later. Now, all this has to do with this loss of knowledge, knowledge of principles, knowledge of the cosmology that laid behind this art, its symbolism, in the same way the loss of the worldview that made ethical actions meaningful, not just arbitrary. All right, you don't need pork because God said so. All right. There are things like that are hard to understand. But everything in religion, you should try to apply your intelligence to understand. And religion always provided the understanding. It isn't that people of old were all had stronger faith than ours, therefore they never drank and they never ate pork. No. It was that sometimes things were explained to them much better than they are to some of people of our generation. Now, let me conclude. I ask this question of ourselves. Why do we need metaphysical knowledge? And I want to go over this list again from another perspective to make sure we understand. First of all, we need metaphysical knowledge in order to preserve religion. No religion can survive without having an ultimate knowledge of reality or claiming to present an ultimate vision of reality. The Quran keeps talking about heaven and hell all the time. How do we know? Either we say, all right, we have faith in the Quran. But if your mind begins to ask, you end up with so many young Muslims don't believe in heaven and hell anymore. How many have I met in my life? Because they don't understand it. There has to be a metaphysical perspective. Okay, if you give me a few hours, I'll explain to you why there has to be a heaven and hell. Why there are states of being. Why states of being have been sent from the most perfect state of being, which is God. Why there has to be descent. Why there has to be manifestation. Why there has to be creation. And once you have creation, you have separation from God. And since only God is absolutely good, the separation is evil. And hell is separation from God. That's what it is. It's the metaphysical understanding for a simple person how to have to explain in simple terms. We need this. Otherwise, even the language of the Quran becomes opaque and we choose and select certain verses for our convenience and forget others. So the primary thing is to preserve, resuscitate this knowledge. Now, God has not only given us oil which the former president of Yemen called the urine of the devil, and it wasn't completely wrong. It's done so much harm to us compared to some of the good. But we have unbelievable treasury of knowledge in our tradition, especially in Arabic and Persian. Very, very few traditions, including the Western especially, has so many works that are devoted to metaphysics in the real sense of the term. In poetic language, in prose language, in simple language, difficult language, symbolic language, abstract language. It happens to be my field. I've read so many treatises, unbelievable, the diversity of languages, different audiences for which it is meant. We need some heroes to resuscitate this. Not only leave it in the hand of Orientalists to publish the text with a thousand criticisms and make it opaque for our young people to really benefit from it. We need the unbelievable courage. Not only these two languages, but also Turkish, Urdu that came later, Bengali, many other languages, Punjabi, many. But especially these two major languages of Islam, Arabic and Persian. There are hundreds upon hundreds of unbelievable treatises. Only about 10% of them are available. Even original printed texts, not to talk about translation. And you're not to be blamed, young people in Canada or America, if you cannot read a 7th century Arabic text. It's the duty of scholars to make that available. And unfortunately, we've been very bad in this matter. Some countries are a little bit better than others. But it's difficult. It's not easy. When Kemal Atatürk changed the Latin alphabet, changed the Arabic-Persian alphabet to the Latin alphabet for Turkish, it was one of the greatest disasters of Islamic history. He said within a few years, every word the Ottoman work would be in the new alphabet. 80 years later, 90% is still not in the alphabet. Just to change the alphabet, not even trying to translate. So the Turks are minus 90% of their 700-year heritage. I heard they're now beginning to going to teach Ottoman Turkish in schools. Wonderful. Bravo to Erdogan if he does that. I've been saying this for 50 years. If they do that, a major transformation of the Islamic world. But unfortunately, we're sleeping over treasures. We're barking at the wrong thing and sleeping over treasures. And it's not that difficult. We have so much money. We have a lot of young scholars. Instead of encouraging them all to make $500,000 in some hospital, all right, 10% of them do it. And obviously I learn from the Jewish people. Every big Jewish family has, oh, this one person who becomes a rabbi. One person goes to the doctor, one becomes a lawyer. Not all three become doctors. And maybe want a lawyer if he does get into medical school. That's not at all the case. That is not at all the case. I'm just joking. Sam, law school sounds more difficult than medical school, of course. I was just joking. But that's not our case, unfortunately. We have 7 million Muslims in this country, not the 2.2 million at Pew Charitable Trust. There are over 7 million Muslims in this country. Highly educated class. They're already taking over many fields of medicine. I come from Washington, and there are more Muslim doctors than there are Jewish doctors for the first time. And most hospitals, the directors are Muslim. Unbelievable what they've achieved in medicine. Alhamdulillah, but so what? From the point of view of what I'm talking about. Now is the time. We have so many professionals in different fields. To be able to do this, it's not that impossible. And it doesn't need that much money. If you get some halal money, most oil money is haram money, but get some halal money. A few million dollars could do it. And we need to have this be accessible to our people, to our young people, in a language they can understand, and I suppose that is English now. Then, besides the preservation of religion, one of its most important roles can be in preventing at this juncture of history, for the destructive secularized forces of modern science from destroying Islamic intellectuality completely. Fortunately, I might say jokingly, at somewhat fortunately, in some Islamic countries, science is taught so badly that it's not a threat for Islamic life. You don't have to worry. But in some countries, it's not the case, including in Iran, it's at the university which I was the president, as some most brilliant scientists in the world. And MIT and places are full of them. Many of the professors now in places like MIT and Stanford and Harvard and places like that, most have postdoctorates. So there are a lot of very, very important people who should be kept for the Islamic world. And the fact they flee from the Islamic world is partly to do with the fact that they learned the worldview, which had nothing to do with their culture. Many of them come from impoverished families. That's not enough. That's enough. They don't feel the intellectual attachment. And the destructive effect of secularized science is much more pervasive than our rationalistic, fundamentalist friends would make us think. How interesting is that fundamentalism and modernism are united in so many things, in the destruction of Islamic art, in their indifference to the role of a secular science upon society, in fact, encouraging it all the time, and many, many other things, many, many other things. And so we have, of course, a very big battle to face. And then for the preservation of Islamic art. In this one field, alhamdulillah, the last 40, 50 years have seen a certain amount of movement. Thanks to the writing that people like Titus Burkhardt, Jean-Louis Michon, and Western Muslims, and of course some Egyptian architects, Hassan Fathi especially, my own humble writing in this matter in Iran, other places. From about 40 years ago, there began a semblance of movement to try to preserve traditional Islamic art. And that's, of all the different fields, the most hopeful. We have now two schools of traditional Islamic architecture, one founded by Prince Charles in London because he was in love with Islamic art, and the other one in Amman, Jordan, based on that model, which trained really traditional Islamic craftsmen and architects based on classical, philosophical, and metaphysical issues. Tomorrow I'm going to discuss the relation between metaphysics and mathematics and geometry and things like that and how it works in art. Obviously nothing about it today, but all the traditional arts that they relate to art itself, traditional science that they relate to art itself, and some wonderful things are going on. When we come to religious ethics, there's been a lot of attack, of course, in the last 40, 50 years, even in places like Chechnya, where the Sufi order survived 70 years of ruthless communist rule, but oil money from a particular country succeeded where the communist party did not succeed, and they were destroyed, most of them were destroyed. But even in a place like that, there's a great deal of thirst for Sufi ethics. It's being revived in Caucasia, places like this, and in Turkey itself, the tremendous interest. In Iran, not so much in the Arab world. In Egypt there was some, I don't know what's happening now, but in places in Africa, Nigeria, a so-called place of Mauritania, with exceptional places of the part of the Arab world. It's not really part of the wave that we see in the Arab East. In Morocco, other places, and again, this is a field in which the re-understanding of metaphysics can have the deepest effect upon the formulation of an ethics which appeals both to both the intellect and to faith. If you only perform ethics because the Quran told you or your father told you, sometime along, it comes along when you don't understand why you're doing something. And that element in your mind begins to get hold of you and can have very deep consequences even religiously. Many of you have felt this temptation. Shaitan is always around. If we're asleep, he's not asleep. That we all know. He's always awake. And in certain other fields that might not seem to be so central, but it is really, they are really very important. For example, today, a great deal of discussion of the spiritual dimension of religion. In the West, nobody talks about religion anymore, but talks about spirituality. I don't say anyone, but in places like California, which sets fashions in this field, spirituality is very fashionable. Religion is not so fashionable. How can you have spirituality without religion? I don't know. But anyway, very term spirituality, when you translate it back to the Islamic world, has to do with Sufism and metaphysics and things like that. In fact, intellectuality and spirituality are inseparable in the Islamic perspective. And they're not in the Christian perspective. In the Islamic perspective, authentic intellectuality, authentic spirituality are interrelated. And so, of course, the revival of spirituality, which we need so much in the Islamic world. We need those people who wrote the Vindication of Sciences of Religion, Ghazali-like people, who revived the whole ethics from within by appealing to metaphysics. Exactly what Ghazali did. We need that very, very badly. And to talk about spirituality is a very important matter. I'm very happy that just this week, the University of Kashmir, of all places, created the first big center of Islamic spirituality in the whole of the Islamic world. And it's under Indian rule. It's under a colony after the Mohammedan in India. And they asked me to go. Of course, I cannot go to Kashmir, but I send a message for them over these gadgets you people have at. Send messages going on. Well, Skype, something like that. Anyway, there is some interest. I was very, very happy to that. That's exactly what I spoke about when I sent a message to India for the inauguration of the center. That authentic spirituality is not a pseudo spirituality out of California. It's a spirituality that's based on a knowledge of reality, what is real. Why is spirituality important? Because the spirit is important. And spirit is a reality, it's not a concept. It's a part of the spiritual universe that Islamic metaphysics has always taught. A ruh. The Quran speaks that ruh min amri rabbi. It's the highest level of reality. And then the field closely related to this is become very popular, especially here in Toronto, the field of, in Canada, the field of comparative religion. The multiplicity of religions has always been there. It's attested to by the Quran, which, as I said to you, always speaks about with the awareness of the presence of multiplicity of religions. And even when talk about people who are saved, said Muslims and Christians and Jews and Sabians, and there is many reasons, and others you do not know about, Surah Al-Ma'idah. Others you have not even heard the name about. So always speaks in terms of the multiplicity of religions. And the question of the very reality of multiple religions is a challenge to every religion in the world today. It was not in days of old. Armenians were never a challenge to Muslims of Isfahan, although they lived across the river from Islam, from them. And they were not a challenge to the Muslims of Turkey and Istanbul on the same street. There was a church and a mosque. It still is in one street about 200 yards apart. They're both there. In fact, a Jewish synagogue also all through the same street. But they lived in their own closed world. Secularism has destroyed the walls of the homogeneity of each religious universe. One of its consequences is the presence of other religions. Why is it that every young American student so interested in other religions? And so few, let's say, Jewish students are interested. I've often lectured in the University of Cairo. Because they still live in the homogeneous Islamic universe to a large extent, despite secularization and everything. Whereas the American student lives in an open world. And even if you come from a Southern Baptist family, they told you, oh, don't pay attention to Muslims and Buddhists. The very first year in freshman class, either he becomes an atheist or his mind opens up and he likes to study other religions. I've had dozens and dozens and dozens of students like that where I teach. I'm teaching for 30 years at George Washington University. Students from all over the United States, and sometimes students are like that. But he has no choice but to open his mind to other religions. Now, it's here again that Islam has no choice. Islam is very fortunate that it met the multiplicity of religions before modernism. Christianity met it only after modernism. So a multiplicity of modernism go together in the Christian mind. In Islam, Al-Biruni already wrote a book on India, At-Tahrir Malil Hind, in the 4th century of the Hijra, in the 10th, 11th century, discussing Hinduism, Buddhism, Kashmiri Buddhism, and so on. Unbelievable book. The first book of the so-called comparative religion. So Muslims had to the greater certainty with them that there are other religions. They were not worried so theologically. And they did not react so quickly to all this wave of comparative religion, history of religion that was in Chicago, here in Toronto. I was once invited to the 30th, one professor to teach comparative religion. The winters scared me. I'm from Kashan, so I didn't come. No, it wasn't because of that. But anyway, this field did not attract so much traction in the Islamic world until about 20 years ago, 20, 30 years. Now, there are many universities in Egypt, in Iran, in Turkey, in Pakistan, countries I know their professors, who teach, and many other, or Malaysia, of course, which has a large non-Muslim minority, which teach, in fact, various religions. Where does Islam get its philosophical background for this discussion? The Christians are trying very hard to formulate the theology of comparative religion, what they call theology of comparative religion. We have a much easier task. Much more easier task, but that task is based on understanding our own metaphysics. The Quran and Hadith, we don't have to discuss your later source, really explain the metaphysics of multiplicity of religions. God says you could have created a single nation if I wanted to. We didn't say goodbye with each other in goodness. Why did God want us to vibe with each other? There are a lot of discussion on that. Was it just sport for God to sit down and say, we vibe with each other? Obviously, there was a profound philosophical, theological reason to that. And many of our great theologians and Sufis both face that, these issues. And we have, a very rich tradition which speaks about this. I want to end with two issues. An issue that has come very much to the fore in the last few years, about which Muslims have been singularly silent. Every occasion that comes up, I mention, because I think it's, besides purely religious matters, the most important issue facing humanity, the question of the environment. The degradation of the environment, global warming, the destruction of the oceans, dying of the species, you name it, you all know about it. We try our very best not to think about it. Most people try their very best. And of course, everything in God's hands. But I cannot say I'm not going to get up tomorrow morning and say my prayers because everything in God's hands. God has put the responsibility of my praying in my hand. And no Muslim would say I'm not praying because it's in God's hands. It's absurd. This is also absurd, what some Muslim think, and some Christians also. That's all in God's hands, God's plans. It's His nature, He created it, He can do with it whatever He wants. I mean, that's a very common attitude. I've heard it from many, many Muslims and many even Christians, Southern Christians, not Northern Christians, who talk in this term. But surely God has made us responsible. When God said, Alastu Barabbakum, He didn't say, well, you're our God, decide for us. He gave us the freedom of choice. And we have a freedom of choice how we deal with the environment. Now, this is a very complicated issue. It involves economics, politics, all of these things. But those are trivial compared to the fundamental issue of the sacred quality of nature. The desacralization of nature that turned nature into an it to be plundered and raped like she is the last few centuries, first by the West and now by the rest of the world. It's the raping of nature. That's completely against Islamic point of view, completely against the Quran. And Islamic metaphysics and cosmology have very profound reasons to explain why, in fact, this is the case. Why one should not desecrate nature. Why nature is sacred. Why nature has their own say, has their own laws. Can you imagine Rumi has a poem that says, Kashki khilqat zabani dashti, taz serha pardaha bardashti. If only God's creation had a tongue, it could lift the veil from all the divine mysteries. That's our philosophy of nature. For us, nature was always living. It was a brother and sister. Not only the plants and animals, the sun and the moon. How many times the Quran mentioned the sun and the moon sworn by them? By the pomegranate, by a little fruit. It's not little, it was a majestic fruit. But anyway, by fruit, by the fig, which is little. Everything participates in the Quranic revelation. And we are among the worst polluters in the world. The Islamic world is doing a very good job in being first in something at least. But in reverse, unfortunately. I'm being critical of ourselves. I have a right to be as a Muslim. We have to think of these things. Fortunately, the last few years, even in Saudi Arabia, there is a green movement, mostly by Saudi women, on account of many other leaders. But in Iran, we're the first country where the environmental issue was addressed by myself with a great opposition from many others. And we had the first national park system. And before Syria was destroyed like this, Syria had a very good program of natural preservation, natural environment. Anyway, we're in a very bad mess. They have some of the worst polluted cities in the world. And environment doesn't mean just throw your garbage in the can and not in the Nile River. It's much more than that. It's a question of being able to live with the environment as part of God's creation. The environment is not a servant. It's a creature living in this world. And the destruction of this co-creature is the destruction of ourselves. We're committing suicide, obviously. Why was it? And I'll end with this. I was the very first person in the world to speak about the environmental crisis in serious ways, the spiritual crisis. Not Rachel Carson and Silent Springs and a few dirty things watching down the river, but what happened to the worldview which allowed the spiritual crisis. And why is it the Islamic world is the last part of the world, I'm a Muslim after all, to pay attention to this? I've written over 50 books, about 30 in the English language, all of which have been translated into Persian almost, and others in Persian, I wrote in Persian. The last book among to be translated in English into Persian was Man and Nature, which should have been the first. And this is my own country where there is an environmental movement going on, but it's always second to everything else, like the United States. As soon as the stock market comes down, nobody talks about the environment until the next economic crisis is over. Meanwhile, we've destroyed half the forest again until the next uplift in the economic situation. So it's a global matter, but it doesn't mean that it makes an excuse for us. Islamic metaphysics provides one of the most powerful, clear images of the world of nature, what it means spiritually, what it means to our existence here on earth, what role we have in relation to it. The legal parts are stated in the Sharia, but the reasons are stated in our metaphysics. Of course, if you're such a devout Muslim that you don't need reasons, just read the Sharia and act, all right, fine. But most human beings say, why should I do this? Why should I do that? Why not throw dirt in the water and so forth and so on? Why is that little bug important that I should not kill it and so forth? The answers come, in our perspective, from the Islamic tradition. And that part of the tradition which has to do with metaphysics. Now, tomorrow will be my last lecture to you, these three lectures, where I shall talk about the application of metaphysics to various domains. I've partly spoken about that, but in greater detail, to cosmology, what is cosmology, the various sciences and arts and things like that, inshallah, tomorrow. That's it. I think the whole period is ended now, huh? 2 minutes? No, I think I won't take any questions today. If you have any questions, I'll leave more time tomorrow. Because today's lecture and tomorrow's lecture dovetail in many ways into each other, and I'll be glad to answer them for you tomorrow, inshallah.